Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. Kind of exciting to be back on the air for our, first of all, the show's name, A Cloud of Stupid Show. I had a coworker who...
Let the record reflect, we're not your coworkers.
No, you're not our clouds. Yeah.
Or your friends at this point.
But at any rate, she said, I feel like I'm working in a cloud of stupid. And I thought about what a cloud of stupid would look like. And I thought, well, Health Matters. That of course, is the obvious example.
Gee,
I feel just a little bit offended.
A little?
Now, listen, if you guys want
we
to...
We are listening, Tony.
Cutting, incisive, the best hour on the radio, maybe.
I mean,
but
all five of our listeners just heard you just be mean to us.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the MSU Ronald Eglin Space Science Center. Now, with me, back fresh from our Isonville Bureau... from the University of Kentucky as well, assistant professor in the physician assistant program is Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And the executive director of networking and infrastructure for UK to explain to you how you could listen to Health Matters at asynchronously. Uh-huh. My friend, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. To hear that over and over and over again, you would go to WMKY.org, you would find the Health Matters page, and you would find the show dated September 15th, 2018, and there you will hear Tony call us...
A cloud of stupid?
A cloud of stupid. And, you know, normally I tell you how to find it, but since I'm being called a cloud of stupid, you can find it yourself.
Maybe Tony should do that.
Oh, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe Tony should show him how to do the technology on the show.
Click. This is not that hard.
So if you find that offensive or funny or just want to say something about it, jump over to facebook.com/HMRadioShow and let us know. That is your way to interact with the show. It's a fan page. It's Facebook. Yes, we're old. Yes, we like that stuff. It's the best way we've got to give you the two-way interactivity. It's not the asynchronous. It is synchronous, right?
Yeah.
Technically, yeah, you're wrong, Tony. See how I got you?
Yeah.
You're wrong. It's asynchronous because they leave a message and then we get back to them, not necessarily
at the
same time.
Well, I'm sorry, I was busy and then you made me.
That's how the whole synchronous thing works, right? The different directions.
Our sponsor.
Facebook.com, again, is where you can interact with us. We'll leave you some, you know, tidbits for coming out of the media, coming off the show, coming off our brains. There's all kinds of crazy things that you can do there. But most importantly, you can interact and let us know what you think. And we ask you to do that. Again, that can be found at facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, Cervical Cancer Screening Guidelines. There are new cervical cancer screening guidelines.
No or new?
New.
What did he say, Shelley? Did you get that?
New.
No.
New. There are new. Are you happy? cervical cancer screening guidelines from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, and we will talk about those throughout the show. Reminding you of their motto, you can do a PAP or HPV to stay alive, but get your screening every 3 to 5. Annual screening is no longer recommended for average risk people who have a cervix. So we simply don't do the annual pelvic exam. Please get that out of your system if you are at average risk. What we do know about cervical cancer, first of all, just some numbers, because I like numbers. 13,000 and change women will be diagnosed with cervical cancer in 2018. 4,100 will die of cervical cancer across the United States. Kentucky ranks 8th in the nation in our cervical cancer rates. Our rates, as opposed to the top 7 states and the U.S. as a whole, our rates are actually falling. And Shelley, you had some thoughts on that. I thought it was kind of interesting why they might be dropping in the state of Kentucky as opposed to the others.
Yeah, I wondered if it wasn't because so many of our providers are still doing them annually for women just to make sure that we're catching them or making sure that everybody's getting screened.
Yeah, it could be. You know, and the problem is, of course, annual is in everyone's view now is overkill. But for whatever reason, Kentucky's rates are falling. We had 200 cases diagnosed over the past year, and about 72 Kentuckians died of cervical cancer. Now, 72 Kentuckians pales in front of the 3,500 that would die of lung cancer, 800 of colon cancer, 600 of breast cancer. I mean, there are cancers that kill more people. The problem is cervical cancer is primarily a disease of younger women. women. And so there are a lot of productive years of life lost due to cervical cancer. Once again, the key recommendations on this brand new guideline that just came out last month from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. Number one, they continue to recommend screening for cervical cancer every 3 years with a pap smear alone in women ages 21 to 29. This is average risk women ages 21 to 29 every 3 years with a pap smear. Now, once you get to age 30, you have a choice. You can continue to get pap smears every 3 years. You could do HPV, human papillomavirus testing, every 5 years. Or, and this is the way I put it to the medical staff at St. Clair, if you like belts and suspenders at the same time, if you're a very cautious person, you could go every 5 years and do the HPV testing and the pap smear. Now, all of those mean a pelvic examination. The question is, what do they send? Do they send off cells to look for cancer cells, or do they send off a test to look for human papillomavirus? There's a couple of things about this that are interesting. First of all, again, ages 21 to 29. We start at age 21. That's one of their recommendations. Not before then. No matter how wild your teenager is not going to get cervical cancer if they are, unless they have some extra risk factors. So for average risk women, even those who are very sexually active, they recommend starting at age 21. If we did HPV testing, human papillomavirus testing in the 20s, about 20% of people would be positive. And it would be a huge mess because then we would have to do all sorts of follow-up tests and everything, and that's not good medicine. It's not good for the patients. It's not good for the people that are paying the bills or anybody else. So they recommend the pap smears in the 20s. Once you get to age 30, if you still have HPV, human papillomavirus, and you haven't been able to clear it, then you are at higher risk for cervical cancer. So that's when it comes in handy. So one thing is, during your 20s, you get the pap smear every 3 years. At age 30, you can make a choice. The other thing that these guidelines are saying is HPV, human papillomavirus, is the cause of cervical cancer. They're saying, look, you want to screen for cervical cancer, check on this virus. That's how you're going to screen for cervical cancer. And the outcomes, in their opinion, are similar whether you look for the cancer itself or whether you look for persistent virus after age 30. Either one of those, in their mind, is as good. And actually, looking for the virus, you can delay your screening to every 5 years. So we'll talk more about these in our second fractional portion. But it's some significant change.
Well, the HPV vaccine is just important as well. With these, for these guidelines to work, the 3 to 5 years, we're going to have to get our younger folks vaccinated, you know, around 11 or 12 years of age.
Right. Now, as of right now, the guidelines apply whether or not you've had the vaccine. They're not willing to bet a person's life that that vaccine is going to be still working in their 30s and so forth. So they recommend these guidelines no matter what. But I think we are seeing a change in the nature, because of vaccination, we are changing the nature of cervical cancer. We have the potential to eliminate it. Again, if we're saying this is the virus, this is the thing we screen for, if we've got a good vaccine, we should be able to eliminate it, which is pretty exciting.
So Tony, how long does it take for research and, you know, all the various clinical trials and then of course that being out in the environment now and working, how long before we can deem that virus or that vaccination a success? How long is that going to take? 30 years? 10 years? 20 years?
I bet you 20 years at least. I mean, they're vaccinating 11, 12-year-olds, and then we have to see what happens to them when they get to 30 or 40. And you can make assumptions. Like if nobody has HPV at age 30, so we start testing for HPV and it simply is gone, and we believe it is the cause of cervical cancer, we can feel pretty good about it. But I think, you know, we are very conservative about this screening stuff. We have done well with screening. And so I bet it's going to take a long time. But you got to look at these kids we're vaccinating in 20 years and see if they can effectively keep the virus cleared before we'll be absolutely certain that we have eliminated cervical cancer. It is in the realm of possibility, though. And that...
I mean, that's got to be hard from a research standpoint. Essentially, this could be your one research project of your life.
Yes,
and you might go to your death not knowing whether it was effective or not.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of spinoff. My daughter was actually looking at how you treat these HPV-positive cancers versus cancers, not necessarily cervical cancer, but other cancers that are HPV-positive. They have a different, they respond differently to chemotherapy and things like that. Well, what she was looking at was oral cancers, cancers of the mouth, it turns out, can also be caused by HPV, by human papillomavirus. So this is, for me, it's pretty exciting. We're looking at the possibility of eliminating a cancer that affects 200 young women, and many of them then are not able to have children because they have the surgery to cut out the cancer, and then 72 of them are going to die at a relatively young age here in Kentucky alone. And nationally, we're looking at thousands of women, 4,000 and change, who would die and of a disease that we think we may be able to simply eliminate. We had similar success with polio with vaccine. I recognize vaccines are not always good, but my goodness, when they are good, they are superb. They make diseases disappear rather than helping people cope with them or providing temporary treatments. Absolutely remarkable. Our sponsor, Cervical Cancer Screening Guidelines. You can do PAP or HPV to stay alive, but get your screening every 3 to 5. That's every 3 to 5 years. You're going to need to do something to check for cervical cancer after age 21. Next up, first thing, we had a discussion a couple of shows ago about this liquid nitrogen stuff. They pour liquid nitrogen over food, they flash freeze it, you eat it, and then smoke comes pouring out of your mouth, and you are the coolest kid.
There's actually one of those in the Fayette Mall.
The FDA issued a safety alert on August 30th, warning consumers about the potential dangers of eating food prepared with liquid nitrogen. Essentially, serious injury, including internal organ damage and death, can result from eating foods such as ice cream, cereal, cocktails, or others prepared with adding liquid nitrogen at the point of sale. Now, Dippin' Dots, I believe, have liquid nitrogen, but not at the point of sale. They are not. They can give you a pretty significant brain freeze, but they are not that dangerous food. But the U.S. FDA says this is a potentially dangerous food. Now, we got fall festivals coming up, and as you mentioned, Rick, there's a lot of places selling this because it really looks cool to be breathing out liquid nitrogen fumes. But if you get liquid nitrogen in your mouth or if you swallow it, you can do some serious tissue damage. Liquid nitrogen is the stuff we use to freeze off warts and skin lesions, and so you can freeze off your part of your tongue or your stomach or whatever. This is not a good thing.
So being that, you know, we're not real smart.
Stupid, I think, was the term that was used.
Is the whole point that this made it on it because when you put this nitrogen on it, it basically makes a cloud?
It's the archetypical cloud of stupid right here. It's when you have a cloud of liquid nitrogen coming out of your mouth. Hopefully you will survive that stupidity. Hopefully you survive our first fractional portion. We've got to take a break because we're out of time. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the second fractional portion of Health Matters after the break.
Good luck, Tony.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm the dumb one, Rick Phillips.
I'm the other dumb one, apparently, Shelley Irving.
And to complete the cloud of stupid, my name's Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Cloud of Stupid show. And this was not a personal reference to anyone. Rick, of course, who does work on the cloud, was very, very sensitive to
this show name.
I would
rather say I do work in the cloud. Because on the cloud is, you know, very difficult to do unless you're wearing air boots.
Okay. I thought since we have a cloud and somebody has to fix it when it's not working, you would work
on the
cloud.
You don't even know what the cloud is. The whole concept of the cloud for you is murky.
When someone says that, now, you know, it's like you just don't get it, do you? How do you respond to that? Oh, I get it. Oh, yes, I do get it. And so I have no answer to
that. So why do they even call it the cloud? You know, honest truth, though, Tony, in all seriousness, I'm not really sure why, but I almost think it's because when you're drawing your network at the top where the internet is, they somebody years ago drew that as a cloud. You know, it's like it's not part of you. It's out. It's out there. It's not part of your network. And they drew it with a little image of a cloud. And I'm not kidding. I honestly believe that there's somehow or another that's tied into all of this mess. Okay. I think somebody drew it because they didn't want to put a house up there or a big building or a bunch of big buildings or the world.
Our sponsor for the second time.
Again, I just don't get it. I guess that's the best way to say it. But our sponsor is something you should get, and that's cervical cancer screening guidelines from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. You can do PAP or HPV to stay alive, but get your screening every 3 to 5, reminding you of the new recommendations from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. Number one, we start screening at age 21. Teenagers do not need to be screened for cervical cancer if they are at average risk. And that is, regardless of whether they're sexually active or not, there's no need to get pap smears until age 21. From 21 to 29, it is very clear the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and all other guidelines recommend getting a pap smear every 3 years. For people at average risk who had a normal pap smear to start with, every 3 years. No one is recommending for average risk people to get a pap smear every year anymore. So every 3 years from 21 to 29. Now, after age 30, you can get every 3 years, continue to get your pap smear every 3 years, just like you did. You could get the HPV test. It is still a pelvic examination. From your viewpoint, it would be pretty much the same thing you were doing before, but every 5 years. And instead of sending off the cells to look for cancer, they would send a test to look for the human papillomavirus, HPV testing. Or, and they're just allowing this for people who want to be extra careful, you can do every 5 years, you get a PAP and an HPV test at the same time. Any one of those three works after age 30. Up until age 30, pap smear cytology alone is recommended every 3 years. Stop screening at age 65 in average risk women who have had negative tests. There is no reason for an average risk person who never had a positive pap smear to continue getting pap smears into their 70s. And then finally, if you have had your cervix removed, a hysterectomy and your cervix removed, and it was not for cancer, they recommend not getting pap smears anymore.
Yay.
Yeah, because again, if they take out your cervix, there's really nothing to test. Now, if they took it out for cancer or precancerous lesions, then you still need to get checked because there might be some cancer cells that implanted in the back of the vagina, and we would need to know that. So if all bets are off if you've had cancer, none of this applies to that. But if you're average risk, haven't had cancer, stop screening at age 65 or stop screening when you have a hysterectomy and removal of the cervix. That's our sponsor, the Cervical Cancer Screening Guidelines from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which were published in August. Now, this fractional portion starts with me taking another shot at Rick because I can. This was from the August 27th issue of AMA Journal of Pediatrics, and this was from the American Academy of Pediatrics. This was an editorial, but they talked about smartphone usage. You know, the pediatricians are really worried about kids and phones. The phones seem to make the kids dumber. We have some research now that indicates when kids have a phone on the table, their test-taking ability is not as good. When they have their computers open or their phones on their desk, they're not able to take notes and concentrate on the lecture as well. Even if they're following the lecture, their attention is divided. So the recommendation for my medical school kids was don't open a computer during a lecture. You either read the stuff on the computer, or you go to the lecture and take notes, but don't try to do both at the same time. Well, now the pediatricians are saying, well, what about the parents? And I'm just going to read some of this and see how far I can get before Rick throws something at me. Children are learning smartphone habits from their parents. One, demonstrate proper smartphone usage. Take time to unplug and single task. Prioritize quality time with your children. Resist, this one I love, resist the urge to document everything. Pics or it didn't happen. No, resist the urge to document everything with photographs. And so they say, look, parents, if you want your kids to grow up with smartphones, you have to grow up with your phone.
And do you actually believe that nonsense? Just curious, do you?
Yeah, first of all, I think it is time to stop photographing, documenting, and posting everything. I don't care what you had for dinner last night. I don't need to see it.
Okay. So you, I get that, and I've never really been a fan of watching. I mean, I really wanted to start the other trend and take a picture of my empty plate. And it just show people I can accomplish something.
Yeah, this was right? good. Boy, this was good. You should have seen it before I ate it. It
I
was good.
I devoured this plate of food. So Tony, I'm just so the audience knows what I'm doing, I'm showing Tony my laptop because I stay on my laptop all the time. And it's right. a tablet. It's a Surface. And I'm showing him pictures of a whiteboard where we as a group drew things up on the whiteboard. And during the discussion, we took pictures of it to document it. And then there are notes next to it on what we need to do as a part of this drawing. So there are times where you have to learn how to use your technology correctly. You have to. You can't just – so you're, what you're basically saying, Tony, is that to do this right, you have to teach your kids to use pen and paper. And that's wrong. That is wrong in our modern technology because we're going to be forced to use computers the rest of our life. And so we got to teach them how to use them the correct way, not at all. That's draconian.
Draconian, you say? I love it.
It is. I mean, ignoring the technology is sticking your head in the sand, and that's the wrong approach. You got to figure out how to do it the right way.
Okay. So Rick is, he's showing me pictures he took of the whiteboard. And again, it's you work things out on the whiteboard. You erase it. You redo it. And then when you've got it set. Or
you document what you did. And so you have to learn how to document what you need to document. I think we need to teach people that Facebook isn't always about me.
Right. Now, I will take...
I mean, it's a different problem. It's not the technology. It's what we're teaching our people is important in life, and that's wrong.
I have photos of all of my car's license plates on my phone.
I do, too.
Because I travel a lot.
Because when you walk up to the counter and they say, what's your license plate number? I'm not smart enough to remember because I'm part of the dumb cloud.
Yeah.
The cloud of stupid.
Cloud of
stupid.
Got
that. I have... So I've
clearly, you're a member.
Can I... What...
And okay. In this case, the technology and me documenting something with technology actually made me seem like I was smarter.
Back to the pediatricians. Step back and think about your relationship with your phone. Are you sometimes using it as a stress reliever instead of taking a walk or deep breaths? Rick?
Yes.
Oh, they didn't say Rick. I'm sorry. I misread that.
Absolutely.
Are you successfully, sometimes purposely withdrawing into your smartphone from difficult family interactions? Rick?
Do you think there's ever a time when if I threw it at you, would that be stress relief? Would that be a good use of technology?
Rick, think about the aspects of your smartphone use
when
that
do we
stress
get,
you out the most,
are we
such as checking your email or the news. I'm never going to stop because I know it bothers you.
I mean,
create times to unplug and single task with your family and prioritize meal times, bedtimes, and other downtime with your children.
Perfect.
Remember that children watch and copy their parents, so they're learning how to use their smartphones even when the parents don't realize it.
Oh, my God. I want to hurt you.
The more parents demonstrate this type of tech-life balance, the more our children will learn to do the same. So, Rick, unless you want to raise some little IT engineers, you need to unplug your smartphone.
Well, being that my daughters are 24 and 26, that cat's out of the bag, right? I mean, that train has left the station, right? So I you know,
I'm sorry, this is too good.
I mean, now when the grandkids come along, I will show them how to use their tech and make it appear as though they're not part of a cloud of stupid.
I'm going to stop. It was just great, though. I mean,
because, but seriously,
Rick hates the word smartphone.
One, I do hate it because again, when are they? They're not smart. I mean, they're capable of doing the same thing over and over again, and they're repetitive motion, and they do calculations, and they can do all kinds of crazy stuff, but we can use them in a dumb way.
Right. And so you're wondering at this point, what kind of hippies are running the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, that they all want to?
Well, no, I do believe that I guarantee you the people that made this recommendation's average age is over 45. They don't like tech. They don't like their electronic medical record. They can't stand. They just want to get away from it, and so thus they think the world should adapt, and they're wrong. You can't tell a 19-year-old you don't need to use technology. That's a dumb thing to say. You got to say, here's how you use it correctly. Right? I mean, you just can't. We can't just be ostriches on this. We can't say, okay, we're just going to not ever put our face in front of a screen ever again. I mean, Heck, you can't walk through a museum now and have the screens on the wall.
You know, and it's interesting you bring that up because I did not bring it to the show, but I really thought about it. There was an article where they had looked at top-performing employees, and they found that these people would generally they would be in front of their computer. They actually measured what time the employees were working on company stuff, what time they were doing private tasks on the computer, and so forth. They put in these computer monitors so they could see where they were visiting and what they were doing. And what they found was that the most productive employees would run about 52 minutes on average straight on the computer doing productive
focused,
stuff.
Zoned in.
And then they would put it down and walk away.
Absolutely.
17-minute break or take a walk, talk to colleagues or whatever, and then they'd come back and they would run that again. So the ones who were on the computer the most were not the most productive. And also, obviously, you can't be productive in a modern office without being on it some. But zoned in, what they did was they focused on a task. When they finished it, they took a break, they got away from the computer, and then they came back.
So Tony, what if – I know you like the outdoors, right? And you've taught me a lot of things about farming, about taking down trees, about moving things around, how to be a one-man farmer, right? You've kind of taught me some of those secrets. What if I took away all your tools? How could you – and I gave you just an axe and maybe might give you a wedge to cut some wood with.
Okay. I see your analogy. Maybe better would be you give me all the tools, but I can only use them for about 5 minutes and then I have to take a break.
Exactly.
And not have tools for a while.
Exactly. And you got to tend to your farm, and you're really not allowed to use your tools because you might hold one of them up and look at yourself in the mirror, right? You might use one as a mirror, and you might be dumb with your tools.
Well, see, but the thing is, I think you spend too much time trying to fix the internet, and maybe you should just learn to live with human beings for a change.
Yeah, okay. Great. I love your almost analogy. It almost works.
I have learned how to push your buttons. No, your point is well taken that these kids, they're going to get massacred.
Absolutely. And we're raising a generation of kids. If we don't teach them now, we don't teach them right, then all they are is going to be – everything we do is going to be about a piece of food or a new thing or a political rant or something. We got to get this stuff in check and understand the devices that meant to make your life easier. There are times when you need to use it for stress relief, and there are times when you need to use it to do whatever it is you need to do in life and make things easier. But you got to figure out what that balance is, right?
Fair enough. I think the pediatricians agree with you on the balance. I think where the scale is, where the slider is.
Well, yeah, they stop at
balance.
5 minutes. Great. That's I'm sorry you dislike your medical record, dude. Calm down. Right? Medical records are hard.
Yes.
They're hard. You know why?
That's where the cloud of stupid came from, was the person who...
So here's the thing. What's the most complex machine on our planet? You!
The human being.
Boy, I missed that one. Okay, gotcha.
You! And of course, okay, let's figure out a record so we can track everything that we know and do and bill and everything about you. It's really hard.
Agreed.
Throw in all the regulatory stuff and all the insurance stuff, and it becomes impossible for anybody to do it right or easily.
Right. And then Molly Crew stops me in the hallway and says, Mark Twain is the most quotable author ever. And so I have to go look for some Mark Twain quotes. That's the thing. If you were to track what I'm doing, I'm doing this. I'm looking up this. I gotta stop. Okay, what were Mark Twain quotes? Because he does. He's very quotable.
Do you know any?
I know a long one that I won't give you right now about coffee, which is pretty darn funny.
We've got 3 minutes. You've got plenty of time.
I'm going to keep going with some of this health stuff because that's what I understood
the
show was about.
You sure you don't want to talk tech and how much we should use tech?
Yeah, this was John Mandrola. This was a commentary, but it was on Medscape. Right, you can take a break to ruin this segment. Top 10 things I learned about aspirin, and actually I think I've got it down to 9 of them because I didn't like a couple. But at any rate, he went to the European...
Did you just edit the list? Is that what you said?
I did. Well, I try to make it viewer-friendly for our radio fans.
Don't you think that's skewing it a little? Okay. Did you pull out any good ones?
No. He had some things that were primarily aimed at doctors.
Can we vote on this next time?
Sure. If you want to see the top 10 things that he learned, and I made them 9, that's fine. He went to the European Society of Cardiology Congress in 2018. And he looked at aspirin. And I think this is something that our radio fans may want to know. There were two big major trials of aspirin that were, they debuted at the European Society of Cardiology Congress. And he reported out on this in August. There was a trial called Ascend. They had 15,000 middle-aged people with diabetes, and they randomized them to take low-dose aspirin, 100 milligrams, or a placebo tablet. And then there was another trial called Arrive, and they had 12,500 adults with risk of heart disease, but no heart disease and no diabetes, and they randomized them. This is called primary prevention. If you are a person who has diabetes or has a higher risk of heart disease, should you be taking aspirin to try to protect yourself from that heart disease? And what they, first of all, in both of these studies, there was no measurable benefit to taking aspirin on top of whatever else these people were already doing. And that's news. I know a lot of people who are trying to prevent their first heart attack with aspirin. And it turns out if we are monitoring and addressing the other risk factors like cholesterol, about high blood pressure and exercise and so forth, aspirin in these people did not produce a measurable improvement, a measurable reduction in their risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. Second thing, it did have some effect specifically on the cardiac events. It did drop them, but not enough to be significant. So, yeah, aspirin does do stuff, but it just, in this world of risk modification, did not do enough. Both trials, it increased bleeding. Aspirin makes you bleed more. Double the rate of GI bleeding. That's only 0.5% up from, I guess, 0.25%. But it did double the rate of GI bleeding. No effect on overall mortality. Did not increase fatal bleeding, but did not decrease fatal heart attacks and strokes. The event rates in both these major trials of 15,000 people were much lower. That is, heart disease is changing, and anytime we try to compare what we know to what was present 10 years ago, it simply doesn't really play anymore. So in this modern age, they could not show a reduction in fatal events and improvement in life expectancy by taking aspirin to prevent these things from happening. And that, I mean, I had 9, but I'm just going to stop it. I guess that's around 5 or so.
The edit continues.
Yeah, because we've got to get to our third and final fractional portion. So why don't you take a break, and we will too. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and it looks like the cloud of resentment over the cloud of stupid has finally calmed down. This is the Cloud of Stupid show.
You just want the clouds to go away. You and that group you were talking about in the last fractional portion.
The American Academy of Pediatrics and Rick seem to be on opposite sides of a technological divide. And the superior position remains to be seen. I mean, now, I've got to tell you this story before we get to the sponsor. My brother has an unusual relationship with his wife.
Should we talk about that on the air?
Yes, because it's fascinating. My brother's wife, she will complain. She will make a declarative statement about something she can't stand. And as soon as she does, he is determined to do it at all costs. He gets a great
and
joy out of it.
And they stay married?
But the thing that I mentioned this for is she made a comment one time that she really did not like people who took pictures of their food in the restaurant or got pictures of themselves dining in a restaurant. Whenever we eat at a restaurant, he makes sure to bring the waitress over to get a picture of everyone.
A group picture.
A group picture, and make sure that she is a part of that. Or if she's not, he will go ahead and send it to her.
But let's be honest, sure a group picture's better than the picture of your food.
I would agree, but if a group picture annoys your wife, I mean, for me, this would be... This
why
would, be,
would you do anything that annoys your wife? I mean, I'd do that without trying.
Well, I
why
told
would
you.
I try to do that?
That's an unusual relationship. And he, for him, it's apparently a hobby. It, at any rate,
okay.
There's a sharing from the Weaver family with the sponsor is the cervical cancer screening guidelines from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. You can do PAP or HPV to stay alive, but get your screening every 3 to 5. That's right, every 3 to 5 years. Now, let's go over what that means. First of all, if you are average risk, if you're an average risk woman, Pap smears cervical cancer screening begins at age 21. You do not need to screen an average risk woman in her teens. And by average risk, if she is sexually active in her teens, you still don't need to screen for cervical cancer. It is not a cancer that affects teenagers. But in the 20s, they recommend a pap smear, a cervical cytology, they call it, that alone, ages 21 to 29. The reason is, during that period of time, it is likely many women will have HPV, human papillomavirus, but they will clear it. And there are no long-term repercussions from that. And quite simply, 20% would test positive if we did an HPV test, and that would not mean a thing. What it would mean is that 20% of people, after they get their HPV testing, would have to get additional tests and spend additional time in the doctor's office. So, pap smear alone every 3 years up until age 29. Starting age 30, you have 3 choices. At age 30, you can continue to get the pap smears every 3 years. You can get human papillomavirus testing every 5 years. It's still a pelvic exam. It's still, from your viewpoint, very similar, but it's every 5 years, and a different test is sent. And then if you really are a cautious person, you can ask your family doctor, your gynecologist, or whoever's doing your screening, you can ask them to do both HPV and a pap smear at the same time. From your standpoint, it's not any more uncomfortable, but it's 2 tests instead of 1. Now, the points we made, one, don't need to start early. The second point is no one of average risk who hasn't had a positive test before is getting an annual screen. That's too often for this particular condition. And that's not just the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Everyone agrees the annual pap smear is not necessary. And the other thing is, it is saying that human papillomavirus is the cause of cervical cancer. If you want to screen for cervical cancer after age 30, you get the human papillomavirus test, and that will take care of your risk of getting cervical cancer. So that is a big step forward. We are not ready to say that the vaccine works, that the vaccine has eliminated cervical cancer, but it is possible. And so if you have a daughter or a son, you have a granddaughter or grandson, and they are going through puberty, they're getting around 11 or 12 years old, talk to their doctor, have them talk to their doctor, have their parents talk to their doctor about getting the HPV vaccine. This has the potential to eliminate cervical cancer, to cure it, to remove it from the evils that beset our world. So this is really, we think this is going to be very important. But we won't know for a while. We have to see if this vaccine lasts until a person is in their 30s and 40s, and if it can completely clear the human papillomavirus or not before we give up doing screening for cervical cancer altogether. A couple of other things. Average risk person, negative pap smears all their life, stop at age 65. Average risk person who has had a hysterectomy and it was not for cancer and they don't have a cervix anymore, stop getting pap smears and HPV tests. Don't need to do that. That is our sponsor, the Screening for Cervical Cancer, the new screening guidelines from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. Now, it is flu vaccine season. It is time to get your influenza vaccine. We do, at Health Matters, we recommend you wait till October, but they are out there as we air this show. The good news, the Flu Mist nasal spray is back.
Back.
The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the CDC says for people ages 2 to 49 years old, the Flu Mist nasal spray is an effective alternative. They have reformulated it. It is an effective alternative to getting a shot. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics disagrees. They do not recommend the intranasal flu vaccine.
And why do they not recommend it?
You've asked me, and I don't know the answer to that. I know that they don't. I think it has to do with the fact that they're not convinced that the problems of the nose spray have been solved. The CDC is convinced. They said this is a perfectly acceptable alternative. Any one of the vaccination forms, including the flu mist, is available and should be used. We had this conversation on the way over here. I think that the choice between giving a child a shot and giving them a puff in the nose, I think would certainly influence me if I had young children. But the American Academy of Pediatrics, talk to your pediatrician and ask them, why do you insist on sticking needles in my kid?
The debate will commence in my house, I'm sure.
Okay. Now, a couple of other things. Following two seasons where the committee recommended you not use it, they have decided it is an option for those whom it is appropriate, and that's ages 2 to 49, people with intact immune systems. It is what we call a live attenuated virus. That means that the virus cannot, reproduce and cause the flu, but it is not killed like the shots are. This may theoretically give you an advantage because the virus, it also trains your nasal passage. I don't know why I said it that way, but your nasal passages and your upper respiratory, it allows them to get ready for the influenza virus, and it may provide an added level of protection. It didn't in previous seasons, but that's the theoretical advantage. Secondly, no needle. That's pretty neat. People with a history of egg allergy, any severity, may receive any licensed vaccine. It's an interesting thing. They said, look, there's really not any eggs left in the vaccine. And so if you have a history of egg allergy, you do not have to avoid the vaccine.
You trust that?
Yeah, I understand it. I mean, I have no reason not to trust it. That is, they're saying, look, these vaccines don't have enough eggs in them. The vaccine's grown in eggs, but then it's removed from the egg. And when it's removed, they scrape all the egg off the virus using tiny, tiny spatulas, and they get to the point where there isn't any egg there. And they said, look, you should not, it's an egg allergy, don't avoid flu vaccines of any type. Now, what if you've had a person who had a history of a reaction to the vaccine? That's a little bit different. I mean, eggs are one thing, the vaccine is different. If you had hives or a rash, go ahead, get any vaccine. If you have had a serious, you went into respiratory distress, you may have almost passed out and so forth, it said you should have the vaccine in an inpatient or outpatient medical setting. You need to have the ability to get access to healthcare quickly. I think the point is, if you've had any type of reaction, I would wonder about the drive-through vaccination, the vaccine on the sidewalk, the all those rallies that we have trying to give more people more flu vaccine. I think at the very least, I would want to get vaccine and then go and sit in the emergency room waiting room for a while. So if I collapse, there will be emergency room doctors next door. Or in that case, I'm not sure, again, that I would feel comfortable at a grocery store or a pharmacy unless they had healthcare providers next door. Because if you've had a allergy to a vaccine, I'd want to do that. But other than that, they say you can still get them. There is no post-vaccination observation period specifically for egg allergic persons, but they recommend observing people for 15 minutes following administration of the vaccine, of any vaccine, to decrease the risk for injury. So it's something you think about. I mean, it's really convenient to get it at the pharmacy. But unless you have somebody who could intervene, there is a very, very slight risk. And the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices says you should be watched for 15 minutes after any vaccine. Timing, it's recommended the vaccine should be offered by the end of October. That's her timing. Now, the flu season typically peaks over in February. The vaccine does wear off. They do not recommend revaccination, though. There's no proof that revaccination is needed. They recommend it end of October. I've told my patients, yeah, I think October's the best. I think it's pretty key to get the flu vaccine before at least 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. Because you really, really want to be vaccinated when all the family gets together for Thanksgiving. That's when things start to get serious. We've had some early outbreaks, though. We have. 75% of influenza seasons from the 80s through 2017, the peak activity is January or later. 58%, the peak was in February or later. So influenza tends to peak in the real winter months. Is December a winter month?
Yes.
I just don't feel wintry in December. I mean, it's cheerful. There's all kinds of colored lights and evergreen trees and all that stuff. In January, it just starts to get serious for me.
I don't think it's winter till it snows.
Well, it snowed in Halloween. I remember going trick-or-treating in a snowstorm. So that's no good at all. I don't accept that.
Well, that's my rule.
Okay. Don't have to accept that. Whose business is it anyway? All right, what about people with higher risk for medical complications? Everybody over 6 months of age should be vaccinated every year, is what the advisory committee says. People who are at higher risk, people who have lung disease, heart disease, some types of cancers and so forth, people who are immunocompromised, maybe their organ transplant or so forth, women who are or will be pregnant during the influenza season. These are people we actually target. We want to get the influenza vaccine to those people because there is potentially more benefit. There was, we did have an influenza outbreak that seemed to target, the outbreak targeted pregnant women and caused a great deal of problems. People who can't take, people who have to take aspirin might be at risk for, there's something called Rye syndrome if you are taking aspirin and get a viral infection. Nursing home residents, here's one, American Indians and Alaska Natives. Native Americans, higher risk of flu complications. They would be people that especially benefit from influenza vaccine. People who are extremely obese with a body mass index of greater than 40. And the people who care for them. So that's why I believe the University of Kentucky will not let you practice medicine inpatient unless you have had a flu vaccine. That's not evidence-based. That is, we don't know for sure that that works, but they have chosen to go that route. St. Clair is the same way. It is a mandatory vaccination. Remember, if your child is 6 months through 8 years of age and this is their first season for influenza vaccine, they need two shots. I'm so sorry, but they need two shots. Children 6 months through 8 years who have previously received two total doses of vaccine, they only need one shot. But the two doses don't have to be administered in the same season or consecutive seasons. So if your child has ever had a flu shot, then they get their second one. But if your child has never had a flu shot, they should get two about 1 month apart. Pregnant women, all women who are pregnant or who might be pregnant during the influenza season recommended they receive the flu vaccine. Influenza vaccine can be administered any time during pregnancy, before and during the influenza season. There is no reason, if you are pregnant, not to get the flu vaccine. It is very, very much, much safer for your baby than influenza. Again, dead virus, live virus. Which would you rather have? For people over age 65, there is a formulation, a high dose or a standard dose. So once you get to over 65, and I am getting close, then you get a whopping load of virus because your body just simply doesn't respond as well as it used to. It's sort of like you yell at your immune system. Hey, what if you're traveling to the Southern Hemisphere?
Where's that?
And you're the one that protests the cloud is stupid show.
I just like knocking you off your game every once in a while, right?
Well, what's interesting is the flu vaccines that are licensed in the U.S. are not for the Southern Hemisphere flu. Surprise, surprise. I mean, we don't have the Southern Hemisphere flu here. So the ones you can get in the United States are no good for the Southern Hemisphere. If you're going to be there for a month, get the vaccine when you step off the plane. But otherwise, you're kind of on your own.
What if they bring the flu from there up here?
Yeah. Well, they could. But keep in mind, our winter is their summer. So it's like we've got our own
flu. So they can bring the flu up here in the middle of our nice summer lake time.
Yeah, but it's not going to do very well here because it's summer and influenza doesn't do well in the summer.
Okay, if you say so. I trust you, Tony. You're the smart one here.
And on that high note of intellectualism, let's get the show off the air, Ray.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
the U.S. Food and Drug Administration alerts consumers and retailers of the potential for serious injury from eating, drinking, or listening to food products. I'm not sure how you do that, but hey, figure it out. Prepared by adding Health Matters at the recording studio immediately before consumption.
These products are often marketed under the names Health Matters Breath, Dragon's Breath, or other similar names.
I have Health Matters Breath.
I like that one.
Health Matters, although non-toxic, can cause severe damage to ears and internal organs if mishandled or accidentally heard due to the extremely low intellectual levels it can maintain.
Listening to Health Matters may also cause breathing difficulty, especially among individuals with asthma. This safety alert advises consumers to avoid eating, drinking, or listening to food products prepared using Health Matters at the recording studio and immediately before consumption due to the risk of injury.
Food and drugs prepared by adding Health Matters at the recording studio may be sold in malls, food courts, kiosks, state or local fairs, and other food retail locations.
Food or drugs?
Yep.
May include Health Matters infused colorful cereal or cheese puffs that emit a stupidness or smoke-like vapor. Similarly, alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks prepared with Health Matters emit a low IQ fog.
Ouch. The FDA has become aware of severe and in some cases life-threatening injuries, such as damage to ears and internal organs caused by radio show remnants still present in the food or drink.
Injuries have occurred from handling or eating products prepared by adding Health Matters immediately before consumption, even after the Health Matters has fully evaporated due to the extremely low IQ of the food.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week and make a healthy change in your life. Tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.